Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor at the Investors Chronicle. I'm joined today by Harriet Russell. How are you doing, Harriet?
Yeah, good, thanks, John.
Excellent, busy week?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. Well, you wrote Taking Stock, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
We will talk about company reporting, a report that came out from a consultancy who I'd never heard of, but I have now, called
Radley Yelder.
Mm. And what's this about?
It's basically looking at why there's this whole host of reporting which is sort of underutilised by investors, but it's also changing, and what investors might be able to get out of those changes, and sort of looking at it in a much more holistic way.
And they've kind of ranked the usefulness of various companies' annual reports.
Yeah,
and,
that's what first kind of caught our attention about the whole thing was, I mean, not to spoil it, but Land Securities did top the list for the third year running.
All right. And Phil Oakley, how are you doing, Phil?
Very good, thank you.
Excellent. And we're going to talk today about house builders, which you've written about in your Alpha update. And we're all going to chip in to a little discussion about the supermarket industry, specifically Cardo, which had results this week.
Mm-hmm.
And then very shortly after those results, all hell broke loose.
Yeah.
Almost literally.
The results were out at the usual 7 a.m. and at 12:56 p.m. to be precise, they announced that their Andover distribution centre had caught fire.
Right. So, I mean, Ocado is a company that I have long struggled to get my head around. To put my cards on the table, I don't like it. I don't buy the story. I mean, it's kind of changed what it is over the years. Now it's a tech stock. But we've got some questions about it. Phil's shaking his head there. And Phil, before you came in, I mean, it's not a company we looked at in great detail, but we had a quick look at the numbers beforehand. And I know you have some very strong views on this kind of thing. Before we come on to that, we need to ask whether the results themselves were any good. This, after all, was the best performing share of 2018. So is it living up to that incredible performance?
Yeah, I mean, shortly before we came down, I said to you, it's one of my most trolled stocks, because about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, I tried to sell it. I agreed very much with your point of view, which is that it's not a share worth having. And
although I was wrong.
Yeah, I mean,
in pure performance, yeah, share price performance sense,
totally,
I was wrong.
And I was too. And let's say thank you, dear readers, because you let me know. But having said that, my overall view on the stock is and has been consistently pretty negative. And no, these results don't change my mind, in short. But if you're asking me if they're a good set of numbers, the answer is it depends what numbers you look at.
So what numbers should we be looking at?
Well,
so let's take a turnover.
Yeah, so
revenue.
The company really want you to look at revenue, like a tech stock, which is up 12.3%. Average orders per week are up. So you've got good volume growth behind that number, which is where you would want any retailer, if we're looking at it as such, to be. And they make a lot of sort of noise around cash profits as well. The problem with cash profits is that they were actually down a fifth year on year. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that they have signed all of these international new partnerships. And as well as developing those, they're developing their own capacity in the UK. And it's costing them a lot of money, frankly. And no one quite knows how much money, certainly in terms of any long-term projection. And it's all rather opaque. And I'm not really sure why you're going to pay out when you can't even value it on a price-to-earnings metric for that sort of growth. It's not astounding growth. It's not anywhere near an ASOS or, you know, any of those other stocks that have been accused of moving into the tech space.
And that turnover line, it's not exactly a big number in the grand scheme of the tech industry.
Yeah, exactly. Any of those tech stocks will be able to report turnover growth in the range of sort of 50%.
And presumably quite a lot of that turnover is still coming from the sort of humdrum business of selling groceries.
Totally. And there's it's had renewed speculation this week. There's been a lot more attention paid to it because people now think that maybe they might be signing up Marks and Spencer's as their latest sort of contract.
And this is what has been driving the share price.
Yeah.
These deals that are essentially for its technology platform. So you know, I mean, I remember hearing many years ago, no, this is not about the business selling groceries. We're using it as it's a kind of proof of concept of this technology that we have, this robotic picking, and, you know, the deals will come. And they came and everyone said, okay, you were right. But we don't know much about them. This, to me, remains the problem.
Yeah, and nor do even the analysts. And that's when I get really worried, is when I phone the analysts and say, what do we think about this? What do we think about that? And they say, we don't We don't really know.
And they haven't given much detail on the rumour with Marks and Spencer's. Have they actually formally announced anything?
No, nothing at all.
So it's just a rumour?
Just a complete rumour. It was broken, I think, in the Mail on Sunday, if that's correct, last week. So they've obviously got some sort of insider telling them something. But no, the company has not addressed that rumour at all.
Well, they've been mentioned for years. With Ocado, Marks and Spencer's. You know, the company that has been so poor in selling food over the internet. And obviously, they're seen as perfect bedfellows for each other.
Yeah, except John and I have an issue. And it doesn't happen. Because we often think that Marks and Spencer's sits quite apart from a lot of other food retailers.
Well, it's a convenience retailer.
Exactly. As in, it's not a weekly shop, need it delivered online.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, it's a convenience retailer. It's you go in there, you know, with a basket rather than a trolley,
totally,
and you buy
some
things that you need to make dinner that day or for a couple of days.
Well,
or you go in there to buy your love sausage.
Oh, God.
For Valentine's Day.
Let's put that in context.
I'm not making a smutty joke here.
No.
That's Marks and Spencer's smutty joke.
I know, terrible. From their Twitter feed, which you have conveniently printed out for us here. Thank you.
I just can't. My Mark's fave. Not mine. it's a convenience retailer.
But sort of going back to Ocado, I mean, from what I've sort of, my sort of patchy view on this, they've done a deal with Morrisons, Casino in France, and Kroger in America. Are those the three big ones?
There's been another one, Sobeys and ICA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where's the cash flow coming from these deals?
Yeah, totally.
Where's the profit? Where's the from these deals? Or are these, you know, is this the jam tomorrow that hasn't come yet?
I mean, my big question about this versus, say, a software platform. You know, a software platform, you build it once and you get a bit of code that you can then, you know, it costs you a lot to build it, but then you can sort of almost sell it, you know, ad infinitum without incurring extra cost. This model... And this is where I struggle to get my head around. Please correct me if I'm wrong. It requires a massive warehouse to actually make it work.
There's a huge construction
business. So there's a huge cost to build it.
Yeah, there's huge amounts of cash being shelled out here.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's like, you know, forget all this stuff about, is it a tech stock? Is it a food retail stock? It's a company. Yeah, it's a company. If you're an investor looking at a company, you want it to produce profits and you want it to cash, and you want that to come and flow to you. And this is not happening with Ocado. Ocado is shelling out more and more cash, and no cash is coming back. There's nothing left over.
And in fact, last year, they asked their shareholders for cash. They did a placing.
Yeah, I think you looked at that, Phil, didn't you? You put some very quick numbers together on the cash burn, on the money that's come in.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, that since... I went back and looked back to 2007, which is the numbers that we've got. There's been £1 billion of money invested in this business. And there has been around 600, 700 million of equity raised from shareholders. And there's been an outflow, a cumulative outflow, of 400 million of free cash flow. This company has never produced any free cash flow. So there's trading cash flow, but all the trading cash flow is going back in terms of warehousing, IT spending, that kind of thing. And the trading cash flow in subsequent years isn't growing enough so that there's actually something for shareholders left over.
I guess their argument would be, yeah, but that's going to come one day when we are the dominant global platform for robotic store picking.
But it's always tomorrow. You know, this is a company that's valued as a market capitalization of 6.7 billion. Just check before.
Yeah, because actually it's 6.9 as per our results story.
Oh yeah, because I've got 6.6 here, but I guess it rose after the results and then it's come back down again after the fire. So, still very expensive.
So you have to ask yourself, you know, forget what, you know, just look at the valuation, because this is the thing that, you know, you can look at the business and you look at the valuation. Of course, you have to look at both together, but you have to ask yourself, what kind of profit is a company valued at 6.7 billion? What kind of profit does company eventually have to make to justify that price tag? And you're talking, you know, eventually 500, 600, 700 million of trading profit. And, you know, if you look at the forecast, it's losing money and it might make 50 million quid in 3 years' time or 2 years' time. Now, 50 million, if I'm a business person looking to buy this company outright, and the market's put £6.7 billion price tag on this, and I'm getting 50 million quid back in trading profits in 2 years' time if the forecasts are right, that's not a good deal.
Yeah, absolutely. No. I think the comment you made earlier, Phil, was that, you know, this should still be in private equity or VC or you know, whatever you want to call
it. Yeah, it's a complete speculation. And I don't mean this to be, you know, aggressive about it or derogatory about it in terms of, you know, being nasty. But, you know, I'm sure that there's a genuine attempt here to create something very meaningful. But at the end of the day, as an investor, you've got to start seeing the cash.
Well, and it's interesting because a comment from Tim Steiner in the results statement said, our growth story is only just beginning.
Well, it began over 10 years ago.
Your mind boggles. You just think, how can you be so...
Well, it's chutzpah, to say the least.
This is a business. This has been in business 20 years,
yeah,
hasn't it?
Yeah.
Is it 20?
I think wasn't it part of John Lewis once upon a time?
I thought it was a startup coming out with some guys from Goldman Sachs, including Tim Steiner, putting this thing together. It's over a decade anyway. I mean,
John Lewis owned a stake in it, didn't they?
They may well have done, because you've got the Waitrose relationship.
Yeah.
Which is coming to an end as well.
Hence the Marks & Spencer speculation. That was going to be my final sort of bit on that, was to say that obviously the Marks & Spencer rumour has gathered pace because the Waitrose contract expires next September 2020. So there's this whole kind of like, we've got a high-end UK supermarket gap to fill, and could Marks & Spencer's do that? I personally think our point still stands, that what Waitrose does in food retailing is starkly different to what M&S does in food retailing. So
it actually might not even plug the gap.
No.
But what I don't know, what have Waitrose said? Are Waitrose still going to use Ocado? Because the agreement ends, but they can still use them, can't they?
Totally, and they can renew the contract.
Yeah.
So, you know, until Waitrose comes up with a better plan, I'm not really sure why people think that September 2020 is this sort of final deadline.
But there's not a lot of growth in Waitrose.
There isn't, but there is market share. And Marks & Spencer's, unfortunately, and this is an oversight in Kantar's data, doesn't always fall into the same market share kind of appropriation. That's why I would say the market doesn't view what M&S does in food retailing in the same way as traditional supermarkets.
Do they not fall into the other outlets, symbols? I've got some figures in front of me here.
They may well, actually, but...
But they're small.
It's marginal.
Not as small as Ocado.
No, and they will never break that out, Kantar,
But what's the cost going to be? Let's say you get a deal with Marks & Spencer's, and we've already alluded to it in terms of basket size. So it's going to have, unless you put all the really expensive treat foods that Marks & Spencer sells, it's probably going to have a lower basket size than the standard Ocado business. So what's the actual profit of delivering that to somebody's house? Is there a profit in it at all?
Yeah, so I mean, Ocado basket size, what is it, 80, 90 quid, something like that?
Yeah, the average, I mean, it fluctuates. But yeah, it's anywhere between, it's around the £70.
It's a weekly shop.
Yeah.
Whereas, yeah, as you say, you know, M&S, you go in there, it's 30, 20, 30 quid.
And let's be brutally honest here. None of the supermarkets have given, you know, concrete proof that they can make meaningful money delivering groceries to people's houses every week.
Yeah, I don't know. You're right. I mean, I know what we shop. We shop online. We buy from Sainsbury's. I can't see how that... We pay a little delivery fee.
But you look at Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Tesco, they're all making 2-3 pence in the pound profit. Tops.
Yeah.
I know Tesco wants to get to 4% with the help of Booker and sacking lots of people and that kind of thing. But these are thin margin businesses before you even start layering on the delivery costs. Most of it's in-store picking. We can see that even with Ocado, picking out of a warehouse is making nothing. And then, so how on earth are you actually going to start turning this into a profitable model when there's so much competition in supermarkets in the first place? And then you're laying on delivery costs. You know, the consumer is only going to have so much tolerance of how much they will pay to have it delivered.
Mm.
And the question is, you know, you're not going to be able to get the consumer to pay 15 quid to have it delivered, probably.
No, I suspect not. I mean, you know, I guess one response to this, which you've alluded to, Tesco, Booker, build scale. You know, something that we talk about in the magazine this week in a feature written by Philip Ryland, which is our sort of secondary feature because we have a supplement, which is the main feature, is around the Competition Commission, or what is now called the Competition Markets Authority. And this was really prompted by what's happening at Sainsbury and its potential merger with, I said merger, question league, is takeover, merger?
Merger.
Merger with Asda. Now, I guess we have some views on this. Philip's view is that, you know, the Competition Commission, Competition Markets Authority even, might get tough with this deal. So building scale in this way is potentially not the answer for someone like Sainsbury's. We haven't looked at this for a while.
Not for a while.
I just get that. I mean, Sainsbury's, it seems to be all quiet on the Sainsbury's front. And I wonder that it's keeping quiet because things are not going great there.
No, they've been moved up to a second phase investigation from the CMA, which they claim they always knew was going to happen even before they mooted the deal. So what that tells me is that the CMA, you know, Philip's correct, the CMA is correct, is ready to get super tough on this deal if it has to be.
Is that because it was super lenient when it came to Tesco Booker?
Yes, I think so. A lot of people were very surprised in the end that Tesco Booker basically faced absolutely no repercussions for that deal.
Although they were kind of different businesses, so there were sort of legal arguments that meant it could get around some of the competition concerns.
There was a convenience store business in there, though.
Yeah,
that's true.
That was the big problem. People expected some disposal on that front to make it more kind of lean and obviously less of a dominant force afterwards, but there wasn't. But I think, John, your point is a good one, which is that Tesco Booker, at least to my mind, and this is how I think about it, to me is a very vertical deal, and Sainsbury's Asda is a very horizontal deal. It's a flat deal. It's about scale. It's about more outlets. It's about building market share that way. Tesco, to me, was much more about how can we take control of basically our entire supply chain and take quite a lot of pricing power in the market.
And go into different areas. I mean, Booker has, it's a distributor, it's a cash and carry essentially, but also servicing the food service market, so that the restaurant industry, which obviously Tesco doesn't do.
Absolutely. So not only could it then supply itself via that wholesale chain, you're right, it could supply any number of food related businesses. Not a totally vertical business, but to me that's how I look at it. It's like a up and down versus a straight across. And looking at the market share data coming out of Kantar, at least for the sort of Christmas period, it was very interesting to see how that might change.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've got the data in front of me. Sainsbury's have got 15.9% of the market, Asda 15.3%, although they've been going backwards over the past few years. Tesco got 27.7%. This would make Sainsbury's Asda the biggest supermarket in the country.
It would. The interesting thing about that is that Asda grew over Christmas in terms of market share. Sainsbury's slipped back. So
But Asda had been having a very tough time before that.
To say that market share over Christmas as well is also one of those really difficult metrics where obviously it gets this sort of abnormal boost. They had a very difficult autumn, supermarkets, and a lot of them went backwards. But if you look at the sort of plain data as it stands, Tesco is way out in front, and the Sainsbury's being the second is furthest back. But then you're also looking in terms of fastest growing versus slowest growing, and of course the fastest growing is not the behemoths at the top, it's the discounters.
Aldi, Lidl, they're still going the right way. And in fact, you know, Lidl, I'm sure I've said on this podcast several times, I quite like Lidl. Again, it's convenience. You pop it on the way home. You pick up some grub, you pick up a cheap bottle of gin or some Duff beer, which I'm actually allowed some Duff beer. You know, they're not online. And probably for the reason that you alluded to earlier, Phil, that what's the point when you're selling a small amount of food in small baskets for people passing by?
Well, and their business model demonstrates that if you have real value for money offer that people agree with and can get on board with, then they're willing to make the trip. We say this quite a lot when people talk to us about the death of the high street, don't we? Which is that if you've got something to sell that people actually want, they will go and buy it. It doesn't really matter how good your online is or not.
A Lidl has car park. High Street's car park is rubbish, which I think is one of the problems that the High Street is having, actually. But, you know, that's a discussion for another time. Phil, you mentioned earlier, and I thought it was quite an interesting observation, you know, putting two large struggling businesses together does not, by some magic,
well, it makes a big struggling
business. Big struggling business. So this is my great worry about this tie-up.
There's lots of questions about this deal. It is effectively two struggling businesses getting together and hoping they can solve each other's problems. And their problems are essentially that they haven't got enough shoppers spending enough money with them, and they've got these big stores, lots of overhead, and they can't really make them work. And their pricing is pretty much, particularly Sainsbury's, is out of kilter with Tesco's and the discounters.
Do you think that's a problem for Waitrose as well? I mean, their pricing is punchy.
Even bigger problem for Waitrose. Waitrose pricing is just ridiculous, really. It is, you know, it makes Sainsbury's look quite cheap, in my opinion.
Oh, it does make Sainsbury's look cheap. But I think the shopping experience at Sainsbury's and Waitrose is still starkly different.
I have no idea. I haven't been into
it. I don't know.
I live in a town where they're basically next door to each other, so I often kind of oscillate between the two, depending how I'm feeling. The Waitrose store experience is far superior to Sainsbury's.
The thing is, your Waitrose shopper isn't price sensitive.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, that business model isn't scalable. Because there's not enough people with the money in the pockets to scale it out.
Mm.
Tesco, the Sainsbury's, Asda one, I think it's very, very difficult to see how this gets waved through and you have these two having 30, 31% of the market. I mean, if you go back 15, 16 years now to when Morrison's was trying to buy Safeway, and Morrison's was going to end up with about 10, 11% of the market. Morrison's was forced to sell stores, and the other companies picked them up. And I can't, if this does go through, and of course, the story that's being sold to investors in, or potential investors in Sainsbury's and Asda, put these two together, you have massive buying power, you have Walmart still in the background, you have Asda, and they try and sell a very, very compelling story in terms of the massive amount of profit growth that can come by putting these two together. What's perhaps not being talked about as much is what's the impact if they're forced to sell several hundred stores to a stronger competitor. And for me, I think the only potential buyer is probably Morrison's. I can't see Tesco wanting to buy more supermarket stores. Or being allowed to. Aldi and Lidl probably don't want big stores. It doesn't fit their business model. It doesn't fit, you know, how they have a very, very tight range of products. Smaller stores, selling a lot of turnover and getting a lot of sales density that way. So there could be opportunities for others here, but whether anybody really wants to put more money into big stores, I'm sceptical about. Because it just, if you look at Morrison's and Tesco, from what I can see, they're the ones that are sorting themselves out, getting slightly better, the profits are going up, the cash flow's going up, the dividends are coming through to shareholders. They are ticking along, relatively speaking, quite nicely. Why would they want to disrupt it? Because you see what happened to Morrison's last time they tried to take on a big load of stores. It messed them up for years.
Well, I think, Harriet, there may be a reason why they do it. And I think something you said to me struck a chord, Harriet, which is that Morrison's recovery has gone very well,
mm-hmm.
But it may be sort of reaching its limit.
So they may
be looking for something else to kind of keep that story, that momentum going a little bit.
Yeah, I agree with you. But I think, yeah, Phil's right. I mean, is that buying more stores? I mean, I just don't know how they're going to sort of build that out particularly. They just don't have the footfall increase that I think would ultimately fill those stores. If anything, I think they'd end up cannibalizing a lot of their existing sales potentially from it. And of course, if we're talking from a pure sort of stock picking point of view, the problem with the Morrison's recovery is that, to my mind, it has always largely been in the price. The stock has traded north of around 20, at least 19 times earnings pretty much ever since David Potts was able to demonstrate that this was getting back on track. So getting into that recovery play as an investor has been incredibly difficult unless you were willing to shell out for it, I guess.
Is there anything we like in the sector?
It's really difficult.
Coming back on the Morrison's, I think one of the things, Morrison's is still quite unrepresented in parts of the country. The thing about the Safeway deal, one of the really bad things about the Safeway deal is that Safeway struggled for years because it had a lot of stores in what's termed in the trade secondary locations. They were never able to get the footfall through to make the profits from the business. Hence, they ended up being sold to Morrisons.
They had massive IT problems there as well, if I remember rightly. Yeah. The IT integration, there was either non-existent IT or the integration was an absolute nightmare.
But there must be, I think there must be some Asda stores or Sainsbury's stores out there that could fill a geographic gap in a better location that Morrisons perhaps could get it to work for it. And obviously, that's one of the things that if you're Sainsbury's and Asda, do you really want Morrisons taking you on in the same town? You know, if I look at around where I live, you have town with a big Sainsbury's and a big Asda, and let's say that they keep the Sainsbury's and they flog the Asda, and Morrisons buys the Asda. That's potentially a headache for Sainsbury's.
Yeah, they're quite close, aren't they?
Yeah.
We live close to each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're around the North Springfield area.
Yeah.
What is interesting from the Morrisons results that we had earlier in the year is that they were very explicit about price investment this year as well, which I think, you know, they're obviously turning their attention much more to driving volume rather than relying on inflation, which, as the data shows us from the whole industry, is not the good way to go anyway. So it'll be interesting, I suppose, if they are going to take on Asda stores or just take on more stores in general, that they obviously see themselves as more able to compete with the discounter. They can take that potential hit to margin because they're confident that the volume will make up for it. Mm. That's a pretty confident place to be.
It is, and they've also obviously got their own food manufacturing. So they can put there is a potentially a volume opportunity for Morrisons here for its food manufacturing operations, also in terms of buying power. So obviously we're jumping the gun here because obviously we don't know what's happened, but we're looking at potential scenarios that come out of this. I think Harriet's right in terms of the valuation, but this is, if you were going to put money in this very horrible sector, Morrisons is one where they could be a bit of... The story for me is not Sainsbury's Asda. The story is potential for Morrisons that could come out of this.
Or you buy the beast, Tesco, which has done its corporate transactions. It has a good position. It had a good Christmas.
It had a great Christmas. It was declared the winner by Clive Black, who's Mr. Supermarkets at Shawcat. But yeah, I mean, what's been interesting about watching the Tesco and Morrisons sort of recovery in tandem is that I think the Tesco recovery, even though that initially they were priced very similarly, it completely overshadowed the Morrisons recovery. People just didn't even realise what Morrisons was doing in the background. And because it was so in the price at Morrisons, people just sort of let it play out and potentially missed an opportunity there. What's happened with the Tesco thing is obviously midway through its big recovery plan, it decides to do this monumental deal, which shook a lot of people up, and the shares didn't respond very well. The valuation then starts to look much more attractive if you still believe in that long-term recovery.
I love that deal.
That sort of distinguishes Tesco and Morrisons, that Tesco needed a deal to sort itself out.
I think it was such a clever deal. I really do.
Yeah, but Morrisons has actually done it with what it has already.
Yeah, true.
And it's both of these shares, I think I've mentioned this the last few months, from an income perspective, both these companies actually look quite interesting, because I think if you look at the projection of dividend growth on forecast, these are two shares that in a couple of years' time on today's share prices are yielding 4%. Which I know is, you know, not stonking yield, but it's not bad.
It's decent. And these are stable businesses now.
These could become, you know, quite interesting income stocks.
Should we quickly switch back, before we go into house builders, quickly switch back to Ocado? Because we haven't actually talked much about the fire.
Because it happened after.
This has happened after the magazine went to press, and it actually has some serious implications in and of itself.
Yeah.
So should we quickly just go through those before we get onto house builders? I mean, what is the potential impact of this?
It's sort of worth giving a time frame because, as I said, the results came out about 5 hours later. We get the first press release saying there's a fire, but they've contained it. And that's sort of all we're told. Fast forward to the following morning, we get a second press release saying, okay, actually, we didn't contain it and it blazed all night.
Well, it sounded like a small fire when they first mentioned it. Yeah. And when I saw the pictures, it's absolutely enormous.
It's enormous. You can find the pictures online quite easily if you're interested to look. But yeah, it's enormous. They told us that the roof had caved in and that there had been, quote, substantial damage to the site. This morning, there's another press release saying that it's 10% of their capacity and that the sales impact, or the disruption, I suppose, sales disruption, is going to be significant.
Now, OK, so I'm going to play devil's advocate here in a major way. So Peel Hunt, who are a big bull on Ocado yeah. because they like the tech story, have downgraded it to a hold as a result. But who cares if capacity's gone up in smoke, as it were, because it's a tech story. So I don't quite get this. This seems to be something paradoxical about this. You know, okay, so the numbers, whatever, they're not making any profit anyway. They're burning through cash. No pun intended. But so what? So what if there's a fire? It's a tech play. So why downgrade?
I'm going to highlight another Suedo tech stock, which also had a big fire. Any guesses?
ASOS.
The Buntsfield
exactly. Oil Depot disaster.
Indeed.
Yeah, I remember it well.
And it had a proper impact on their numbers for a little while. So, you know.
They were tiny then at that point, though. They were tiny.
Smaller, yes.
Yeah.
They were. But, you know.
Actually, they might have had another fire after that.
Hemel Hempstead?
Yeah, Hemel Hempstead was the big one.
Yeah.
And they had another small incident many years later when they were much bigger, but Buntsfield almost wiped them out.
What year was Hemel Hempstead?
Oh, 05?
Okay, the one I'm thinking about is 2014.
Yeah, that was a small fire in the grand scheme of
But even
fires.
even that had some impact. Obviously, from an insurance point of view, they're covered, so we can kind of breathe a sigh of relief in that respect.
I just don't understand why if this is an IP story, which a tech play generally is, why 10% capacity being taken out would turn you from a bull to neutral. Just don't get it.
Yeah, well,
I don't have it explained to me.
No. You know, obviously you're losing revenue from selling food.
Yeah, but so what?
But it's a tech story.
Yeah, so what? Exactly.
So yeah, it doesn't affect tech revenue.
Exactly. I'm curious.
Well, as we pointed out at the beginning of the discussion, you know, it's only half a tech story. The other half is physical warehousing.
I think it's extremely confused, and that is my final say on that matter. Let's move on to house builders. House builders dominate your Alpha report this week. You have had a look at Carpet Right as well, which is another company which, as we discussed before we came on air, confuses us a great deal. Because this should have gone bust nearly a decade ago. Don't understand how it's hanging on. Fair play to them. But the share price is ugly. Ryanair, which had some hideous numbers this week. You can read those in the report. But let's talk house builders, because this is a contentious sector that has roared back to life, share price-wise, at the beginning of this year. Is there any basis for that?
I think that the valuations have come down a lot. I think if you look back at maybe a year, 15, 18 months ago, you had a sector that was trading on, if you look at it on price to asset value, which is the way that most people look at this, they were making record high returns margins and they were trading at pretty much peak multiples of book value or NAV. And the profits have kept growing and the share prices have gone nowhere. So there's been a catch-up in terms of profitability with the valuation. Therefore, the valuation has come down. And, of course, there's all sorts of talk about what politics might do to this, which I'm a little bit sceptical about. I think it all just comes down to affordability, really, and house price affordability. But they look quite well set. As long as the market doesn't crash, they've got government support until 2023 now. The profits are still good, still high, margins are still high. And the valuations now are much more sensible. And they are pricing in, you know, they are pricing in a slowdown.
Well, and then, I mean, we have some evidence that slowdown is really taking hold. We had some numbers from the Halifax this morning, the house price index. 0.8% house price increase over the year. That's a real sharp slowdown. And obviously some regions, it's much higher than that, but some regions it's going backwards now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm I'm a bear of house pricing in the UK. I think house prices are way overvalued relative to people's wages, relative to rents. Not in all markets, but you know, in a large chunk, particularly in the south and the southeast. The house builds, of course, have been a little bit cushioned from what's been going on in the secondary market because they've got still got subsidised mortgages through Help to Buy. It's very interesting, actually. If you look at the secondary housing market, that when Help to Buy was taken away from that just over 2 years ago, surprise, surprise, that market started to go soft. And Help to Buy is only on new builds now, and selling price inflation is still fairly reasonable across the sector, some better than others. London market's definitely going soft, and that's an issue for certain companies in the sector. We've seen Crest Nicholson have a lot of weakness in the south and the southeast, and Redrow, which has reported this week, I mean, over half their revenues are coming from London and the southeast. And I think we've had three builders this week. We've had Barratt's, Redrow, and this morning we've had Bellway, and all the figures look pretty decent. You know, the trends there, the volumes are there, the margins are there, dividends are up. But there is beginning to be a theme, I think, in this sector where there are signs of slowdown. Crest Nicholson has been slowing down. We can see that. But looking at Redrow and looking at Bellway, Redrow's order book and Bellway's order book is behind where it was last year. Now, they say that the end of last year was, oh, people were making up their minds about what the politics would be, and they're holding off buying. But I'm not so sure. Cancellation rates are nudging up a little bit in both companies. And the other thing is now is that margins look like they've pretty much peaked, because all the cheap land that was left over from the last recession and the house price inflation is soft levelling off means that the ability to leverage that land and make big profits, for a lot of the house builders, that's gone.
Yeah, I think I wrote in my editorial a while back about a piece of land near the station I travel to work from every morning, which used to be an old dairy, which sat vacant for a long, long time. That's now been bought in the last couple of weeks by Bellway.
In fact. The builders always work backwards from the selling price to work out what they pay for the land, and they always target minimum sort of 20%, low 20% gross margin on that. So if house prices hold up and they sell the houses, they can make good returns. Obviously, we know that if house prices then go more than they expect, their margins expand. If they fall to lower than they expect, their margins start to contract, which is why they always give themselves a big buffer.
Are they having to work a bit harder in terms of incentives? So, you know, part exchange, that sort of thing.
From what I can see, there are signs that is beginning to create. I wouldn't say it was significant. It's kind of holding steady. But obviously that is something that you do look for. If times get tougher, they will have to offer more incentives. The other thing as well is that build cost inflation is still running at the sort of 3-4% level.
But we're seeing some interesting initiatives from house builders in terms of, you know, kind of prefab type approaches.
Yeah, but this is
apprenticeship schemes.
Yeah, and this is definitely a trend. Probably Barratt's is the main one where this is going on. They are looking very carefully at their housing design and their construction, and they are trying to incorporate modern construction techniques. They're using a lot of more timber frames, steel frames, blocks, and sort of standardising and simplifying the building. So these can go up quicker, they can sell them quicker, and they need fewer builders to put them together.
And they can train those builders.
Yeah, but it works, it ticks a lot of boxes for them in that they can put them up for cheaper, they can put them up faster, and they can preserve their margin. And out of the three builders that have reported this week, Barratt's, for me, seems by far the most confident. They are selling they are selling a volume story, probably better than the other two. They are confident that they can keep building 3-5% more houses over the next few years. They are less reliant on selling price inflation. They've got their land. Their land looks to have been very smartly bought. And if you look at the cost of that land that's going to get carried through, they are still pretty confident that they can keep earning quite high, you know, quite high margins in the low 20s and good returns on investment. The other two, whilst they've been taken quite well by investors, I think there are some signs in there that particularly Red Row, with its exposure to the southeast, Red Row's land bank as well is not expanding. That might be for perfectly rational reasons. They think, well, right, we've got enough. But it's interesting that they're not expanding their land bank, whereas others are. And that, to me, just sort of makes me think, are they being really cautious here? Are they trying to bring it back so they haven't got too much money invested in land and they can keep the cash flows and they can keep the profits high? So I think, you know, what you've seen in the secondary market is perhaps now starting to come through to the new build market, in that we are seeing some signs of demand softness. Where we're seeing stronger demand across the board is in affordable housing, but you see that the amounts of profit aren't the same as they are on private housing. And so you've got this change of mix in the selling base. So despite that, though, I would say, whilst I absolutely hate this sector from the fact that it's subsidised to the hilt and it's making huge amounts of money from a sort of fairness point of view, looking at it dispassionately from an investment point of view, I'm probably more optimistic on this sector now than I have been for the last 2 or 3 years, because I think the valuations have become increasingly pessimistic, and they may be too pessimistic. And there may be pockets of value or a sort of a trading opportunity over. I mean, certainly you've seen that in January. Obviously, the politics plays a role. We saw what happened in 2016 to these.
Well, you can see that in the graph you put in your AVRA report. So I mean, that is absolute carnage.
Clearly, that's the big risk. But if this gets sorted out one way or another, given where the valuations of these companies are now, if you get some clarity on that, I wouldn't be surprised to see house builders keep on kicking on.
I think that pessimism point is true of a number of sectors. Certainly true of your favourite sector, Harriet, retail.
The big difference, though, is that these companies are earning very, very good profits still. You can't say that about retail.
You can't stick a house online, I suppose. People turn ourselves into virtual selves.
You can sell a house online, which I suppose is a slightly different argument. But
house builders always attract low earnings multiples. People, rightly, never expect the good times to last. But, you know, if this wasn't a cyclical business, and you just looked at the hard numbers of 20% margins, 20% returns, you wouldn't. And someone said you could buy a business on this for a single digit price earnings ratio, you'd think, great.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying they're going to, you know, they deserve to trade on 20 times earnings. Of course they don't. But I mean, my opinion's worth as much as the next. But it's like, I just think there's a bit of potentially a bit left in these,
but buy carefully, buy and keep an eye on it.
I would avoid, you have to look at geographic exposure. The south looks like it's going soft very quickly, so companies with big exposure to the London and the south, I think you have to tread very carefully.
Yeah, interesting. Well, there you go, lots to think about there. All related, I suppose, to consumer confidence in some respects.
Oh, my favourite topic.
Absolutely. Well, that's one for another time. Thank you, Harriet, and thank you, Phil. There is lots more in the magazine this week, and I think we are about to start seeing results crank up, aren't we, Harriet?
Yeah, I'm in denial, but
we're always in denial about results season.
Yeah, it's coming.
Creeps up on us. We didn't even get to company reporting.
Company reporting, yeah, it's by the magazine. You can read it there.
By the magazine, where you will find out who are the best in terms of company reports beyond Land Securities, who I used to cover property. Mm. I remember their reports always being very, very good.
Yeah. Well, the rest of the list, it makes for some interesting reading, because they're not all shares that we're massively bullish on. So, yeah, take a look.
Yep, good disclosure. We always like. John Barron we have this week. He's talking about large businesses, funnily enough, on the theme of competition and why they, particularly in the UK, have been rubbish at being innovative. He's always been a big fan of small companies for that reason. We have Phil's column, Mackie D's this week. You've been at the drive-thru.
Yeah, looking at McDonald's.
And I guess, I mean, the thing they're exploring the whole franchise theme, and we've obviously had Domino's having some troubles with that in the UK, yeah. And you're seeing what's happening over in the US, or in fact, with a big franchise business worldwide. We have the usual comment from Simon, he wrote us 30 pages last week of bargain shares. He there's no stopping him. We have another 5 this week. Lots in the news section, including an update on one of our tips of the year, and stock screen from Algae on deep value, and Alex Newman looking at rare earths and uranium this week. And of course, we've got our supplement, which is about SIPs and how you put one together, how you go about choosing it, investing in it, and then enjoying it when you get to retirement. The Road to a Perfect Pension has a plan and save for dream requirement, and everything else in the magazine on sale at all good news agents, or get online and subscribe. See you next week.